Canadian television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABC's, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, TVA's Greg David has a conversation with Chris Potter. Chris Potter was born in Toronto and raised in London, Ontario, Canada. An early start in theater and music ultimately led him to finding a calling in film and television work. An actor with great versatility, Chris has a flair for edgy roles. He has accumulated an impressive volume of credits in a 25-year career. Chris is also an accomplished director and producer. On Heartland, he has directed 18 episodes. He has starred in 7 successful TV series, over 550 cumulative one-hour episodes, in addition to numerous TV guest appearances, television movies, and feature films. And we'll hear about all of this and more in Greg's conversation with Chris Potter.
Chris, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I've been covering, well, first of all, we're going to get a little bit into your past. I first saw you on Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. But for the last, I can't believe it's been almost 11 years that I've been covering Heartland, first at TV Guide Canada, and now with my website, TVA.com. So it's a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for taking the time, and congratulations on everything.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah.
So obviously, I do want to talk to you about Heartland and about directing Heartland and Tim's storyline and character development and all that fun stuff. But let's go back in time, because I know that you've spoken about this before, but I really find it fascinating about your backstory and how you got into acting in the first place. You were born in Toronto and you moved to London, Ontario, which was about 40 minutes away from Brantford, which was where I grew up. If we wanted to go to the big city, Tim, we either went to Hamilton or we went to London to White Oaks Mall. So London has a fond spot in my heart.
Right. Well, it was a great microcosm to grow up in. Any university town, I've got to admit, is probably a wonderful microcosm of the world. There's an energy to university towns. So London offered that. Anyway, yeah. I in turn went to Brantford at times. So often for hockey games or things like that as a kid. So
now, not only do you have the universities in London, like you said, but I always got the vibe that it was a little bit of a working class town as well. Am I wrong?
No, at the time, I mean, there were large plants, companies like Kellogg's and mm-hmm. Ford, and so there was a definitely a working class side to London. But because of the university, there was also an academic influenced side to London, which involved a lot of lawyers, doctors, stockbrokers, and insurance people, mm-hmm. Which happened to be what my father was involved in and with London life. So you're right. There were two sides of that town that worked in harmony with each other.
When was it that the acting bug hit you? Because not only were you, academically involved, but you were also involved in sports. So how did acting fit into all of that?
Well, I think it's not like the bug hit me. I think it's it applied to me. I mean, from the time I was a little boy in elementary mm-hmm. school, looking back, I displayed an aptitude for the arts. I was mm-hmm. performing. I played drums at an early age, and
wow,
I took lessons, and I'd travel on the bus downtown to my teacher and so on. So, a couple of times in elementary school, for instance, I did at assemblies, played a drum solo on stage.
Great.
Like, when I think about that now, I think like, wow, what on earth for? And who enjoyed that? But, you could see these little snippets of that creativity showing up from the very early age. And then my mother, who happened to be an exceptional singer, and back in the 50s, she won at that time what would have been the Canadian Idol. It was the Lipton Talent Search, and she won for the women, you know, for the Canadian Idol version of, and she won like $1,000, which was a lot of money. And Paul Anka won for the boys.
And oh my gosh.
So my mom had an exceptional voice. So when we moved to London, she was a full-time homemaker, and she got involved with community theater and in particular musicals. And at that time, the Grand Theater in London was an amateur theater company, and it was run by some people who continued to be involved in theater in London for decades mm-hmm. after. One of the guys' names was Don Flexer. And anyway, my mother got us involved as kids. And it wasn't a forced thing. At one point she said, they're doing Oliver at the theater. Would you boys like to play pickpockets in the chorus? And that's sort of how we waded into it. My parents played endless albums of jazz from Cleo Lane and Johnny Dankworth to show tunes. My dad played Wore Out, the Guys and Dolls album in our house. So yeah. It was always singing. There were always instruments. Then my mother played guitar, and she'd come over and play at the school and sing for our class. And so it was just around me. And I think I, more than my brother, whose name is Tim, so I'm used to being called Tim anyway,
right?
Gravitated to the arts. My brother is a very creative guy, but he wasn't a performer. I gravitated more to performance. It was a way of communicating for me that mm-hmm. I found effective at a young age. So I was sort of somewhat fearless, although always nervous about performing. But, you know, I enjoyed being a part of the production. So I did a lot of chorus work as a boy and singing. And at the same time, because my father coached the football team at Western, and was a former pro football player. My uncle Rick had won 4 Grey Cup rings with Winnipeg. We were heavily influenced by my dad and my uncle, mm-hmm. and we began to play competitive sports, travel hockey and all of that. So the reason I'm mentioning that is that I recall a pivotal moment in my childhood when I was in the dressing room at Oak Ridge Arena. And mm-hmm. one of the guys on my team, we must have been 12 years old at the time, said, "Hey, Potter, are you in a play or something?" And I said, nope. And he said, "Yes, you are. My parents saw you and your brother in a play." And the rest of the guys on the team started to chirp me. And I was so embarrassed. And I was hiding my involvement in theater because it was just so not cool in that environment at that age. And yet, most of the time, I could hardly wait for the game to be over so I could get home and practice guitar or play drums or write something. So by the 8th grade, I had a band, and we were playing at our school.
Wow.
And we were doing cover tunes, you know, at the time, whatever the songs the songs were. But when I look back at it, I saw how ballsy that was because I didn't really understand. I played guitar at that point and sang because not a lot of guys mm-hmm. wanted to sing. So, mm-hmm. and I let another guy play my drum set, and we had a piano player, but we didn't have a bass player. I didn't even understand that, you know, we needed bass to fill out the bottom end.
Right.
So
right.
I can't imagine what we sounded like, but we were very earnest in our approach. And all of those formative years really helped shape and the discovery of creating for me helped sort of solidify my destiny in that I knew this is what I wanted to do. And then as I became an adult, a teenager, and then a young adult, I was very focused on entertainment and in particular rock and roll. So, you know, at that that stage, I had to start to make some decisions that were going to potentially affect my life.
Right.
Like, do I do this or not? And
yeah,
and, you know, I think it's well known amongst the people in where I'm from that we had some very successful groups back then, used to pack the bars, and it was all, you know, we took it all very seriously. And yet, when I look back, we unfortunately did it with a lot of responsibility in mind. You know, it really helped shape what the industry was going to expect of me, no matter what right. I ended up doing in it, whether mm-hmm. it was music or acting or producing or whatever. So they're formative years, they called them. That's what they were.
What was the name of your band?
I had a group of different ones. I sent some pictures to a writer from the London Free Press named Joe Belanger, and I they were from the Western Fair in 1977.
Yeah.
Paul Soles introduced the band Midnight, and that was us. But that band happened to be comprised of Ed Hamm on drums, who works for Heartland in for Technicolor in Toronto.
Oh my god!
In editing, yeah. Colin Stewart, who is well known in Ontario because he was the president of the Musicians Union and so on, and has been a lifetime musician. And Duncan Grant, the late Duncan Grant, whose family played at Orchestra London, his brother, like a huge musical family. So we were kids, but we were already moving in the direction of a life in various forms of entertainment. So that was the first band, Midnight, and then I got involved with a really good rock band called Answer, and we've got some solid tapes of that era. We were at that point 18 or 19. Then I went on the road with a band in a bus called Licks, and we traveled the northern circuit all the way up to Montreal, played, you know, in Hull, Quebec, and then we'd play all the university bars, and which were good gigs because they paid well and their checks didn't bounce. And we played, you know, in Kingston. I remember playing in Kingston right at the time the Tragically Hip was starting. And they were a couple of years younger than us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who are the new bands on the circuit? Well, this band from Kingston's pretty good. They're doing well. And, we traveled around in a school bus that I bought because I hadn't contributed a lot to the equipment and, you know, it's expensive. Technologies. Yeah, yeah. Technology's changed a lot. So I bought this school bus from a Baptist church. It was baby blue and white, and it said West Park Baptist Church on it. And we didn't have time to paint it. So we drove up to do our summer tour in the Muskokas. We would play 2 weeks at we'd play four different bars, the Albion in Gravenhurst, the Patterson in Bracebridge, Inn on the Bay, and the Keetabala. And we had this bus. So the first gig we had to play in Bracebridge was at the Patterson. And we pull in, and a band from Kitchener called Helix was pulling out. They had just They had just played there. And their bus was black windows, and they had some fierce, you know, logo on the side. And we pull in our baby blue, white, and white West Park Baptist Church bus. And the guy driving, who was a friend of ours and didn't have a job, so he became our manager, so to speak, that summer. He turned around, looked at us, and said, "Duck, it's Helix." So we all hit the deck below the windows so that they wouldn't see that we were the next band coming in. We looked like such losers. But it was a good band, and we got asked back, so played quite regularly. But our bus remained baby blue and white all summer.
That's a crazy story. I mean,
plus, you know, if one of the guys met a girl,
yeah,
they'd say, you know, we're going to go over to this lodge where these girls. Can I borrow the bus? Because we don't have car. Like, yeah, you know, the drummer would say, well, I was going to sleep in it tonight, you know, so I'm going to have to go. So it was nuts because you can imagine that school bus driving those cottage laneways,
roads,
you know, mm-hmm. along the lake to some young bunch of girls' cottage. Oh, God. And we had no money. We ate at Mr. Submarine, honestly, every day. I remember one time our drummer said, I need a snare skin, and otherwise I can't play. And we said, well, we got to eat. How much is a snare skin? Mm-hmm. Whatever it was, 15 mm-hmm. bucks. Well, mm-hmm. come on, that's like five subs. We could eat.
Yeah.
He said, well, I don't know. Then I can't play. I can't use my snare. We said, well, flip it over. Flip the skin. He said, I did that last night. So he'd busted both. Like, that's how broke we were. It was crazy. And we ended up having to pay a lot of money because we had a production company that we hired, like two roadies, that we had this huge sound and light package from Triumph. Gil Moore was leasing out equipment.
Yeah.
So we paid these roadies for this truck of equipment that they would set up, and most of the time made us help them. But they were the ones making the money, and we were performing every night. It was gross. And I back then I wore red leather pants because Loverboy was popular, but I couldn't launder them. So I would sweat my ass off all night, and then I'd put these crusty pants on the next night. It was kind of like putting hockey equipment on that hadn't been aired out, you know?
Sure.
It just got worse. Of course, also back then, most of these bars they didn't have strip joints back then. They had strippers in these bars during the day. Like in Brantford, we used to play at the Red Onion or something.
Yeah.
And they had strippers during the day. And then at night, the rock bands would play. And sometimes you had to play a matinee. And so we'd come in, we were 19 years old or whatever, and they'd give us our rooms upstairs in these crummy bars, and the strippers would be up there and they'd have their biker boyfriends. Fortunately, they always treated us like we were little brothers, you know, mm-hmm. like we weren't a threat to them. Mm-hmm. And they liked the music, but it was a strange environment. And, I got punched in the head actually in Brantford, now that I'm come to think about it, by a guy.
Oh no.
At a matinee, yeah. He yelled at we were playing I don't know what it was. We played a lot of Pat Travers back then and Rush and Zeppelin yeah. and stuff. And he didn't like what he was hearing. It was a sound check. That's what it was in the afternoon. And he walked right up and just cold cocked me. And I grabbed him around the neck. I remember and held him by the mic, and I said, I don't know, I've always been fairly quick on my feet, so somehow I said, Dad, what are you doing here? I told you to stop following us. It helped defuse the situation. But, yeah, a few times, it was a hostile environment, rock and roll in bars. You never knew what was going to happen. I'm so glad I didn't continue on with that. Can't imagine.
What's crazy is that, you know, you were on the road around, you know, you've already mentioned Helix and the Tragically Hip. I mean, you were right there in the middle of it when all of these bands were starting out.
I'll be honest with you. We were contenders. Like,
yeah.
we were on that circuit. It's just that, you know, I think that partially answers why I moved in to acting, because it was a collective, always a collective decision with a band, and you really have to have the right combination of individuals who all have a reason to have to make this work. I think mm-hmm. to keep going forward, because it's so easy to say I've had enough. Sometimes people in those situations say, "Look, I just." you know, I'm 30 years old and I'm living in my parents' basement. It's like, yeah. it's like the story yeah. of Anvil, you know,
yeah. yeah.
one of my favorite documentaries. It's just like a love story, that movie, but that's the environment. So if you're lucky enough that you have some momentum and direction and you could make good decisions collectively. Well, we had a situation where two of the guys were brothers and they wanted, you know, rightfully so, to finish their degrees, because we had taken taken a gap year, you know, to get on the road initially. And we all kind of went our ways with no animosity, but acting for me, it was clear that it was just me making the decisions, and I was in some control about my destiny, and it played into my favorite part of entertainment, which was communicating, performing, singing, and communicating with an audience. So that's a bit of a tie-in for me. And I got involved with community theater.
Right.
As an adult. And that's when things really changed.
Yeah. People could obviously go to the story that Joe Bellanger wrote about in the London Free Press about how you made that jump. So let's skip over that. People can go to that link on the TVA website if they want to get a little bit of that background. But looking at your IMDb page, I've seen you in shows like Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, X-Men, Silk Stockings, and Wild Card. You've had a really varied career with regard to your acting gigs. When it comes to choosing those gigs, is it because you need to pay the bills over some of the gigs that you've had? Or is it a script that interests you, character, writers, and directors? What is it that's... Or are they all kind of different reasons?
Here's how it went. Basically, yeah. I got to a point when the door opened for me to step into this business professionally. I was working at London Life. I had, you know, I'd done a few different jobs, but this was my first career. And I was in my early 20s, mid 20s. And my wife, Karen, and I, who had already been dating since high school, we're about, you know, just married, about to have our first baby and so on. And I was just, had come to the conclusion that, oh, I guess this is the way life works. You do something, you know, that you kind of like, and that enables you the time and money to do something you really like, which is going to be called your hobby.
Yep.
And I thought, I guess that's the way it's going to go. And so I'd kind of resigned myself to the fact that my dreams were not going to come to fruition. And I got involved in amateur theater, and we did play after play after play. And most of them, you know, were very average, but it was kind of greasing the wheels for me, kept me in the game, and I kept playing music, but I was working. The turning point for me was, you know, when two people who were legitimately successful in the Canadian theater world saw me in a play and gave me the sort of the confidence and the endorsement that I needed, you know, that it didn't come from the dentist that I was doing the community play with, who was a nice guy, saying, "Hey, you're great. You should be an actor." And I'm thinking, "Well, you're a dentist. You know, I don't know if I should take that." No offense.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate that, but I'd rather hear that from Steven Spielberg, who is not here.
Yeah.
Well, I heard it from Martha Henry, and I heard it from Larry Lilo, and they took Karen and I out one night after I performed in a play, and it really encouraged me to look at it. And that's what it took for me to believe in myself and pay attention to what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I remember asking them, "But I have a house and a baby and a wife. Where's the money?"
Yeah.
And they said, film and TV.
Mm.
And I quickly figured out the TV was going to enable me to have a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So it became my philosophy that, hey, I just got a chance to be in this business. That's good enough for me. I'm not going to nitpick about what it is I perform. Ah. I'm just going to take the job and I move forward. Well, it just happened that the opportunities came quickly at that age. And that wasn't anything special. I just happened to have a right combination of things that people were interested in, you know, that were tangible. People were interested in hiring me. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, quickly picked up by CBC and then did 3 years on Material World. And in the middle of that, I auditioned and I was flown down to by NBC to screen test on the set of Who's the Boss, a Tony Danza set,
yeah,
to test for a new pilot called Coming and Going, or no, called Baby Talk.
Okay.
And it was based on the movie Look Who's Talking.
Yeah.
And I signed, when you do a test deal, you're usually up against another individual, sure, another actor, and you've both just signed a contract prior to getting the job. And this was all new to me. I'd never been to LA. Mm. They flew me down, first class, yeah, you know, limo, yeah, to the thing. And I went out, signed a contract, and then stepped out on the stage in front of all the executives and performed the scene. Mm. And then was shipped off back to this hotel that they were putting me up in. It was all whirlwind.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize what a great opportunity, a big opportunity it was, because it was the guy, Ed Weinberger, who had just done Taxi. And I think Ed Weinberger was the name, or Ed Weinberger. Anyway, he was a big deal back then. And my phone, you know, there were no cell phones. My phone's flashing, mm-hmm, in the hotel room. It's my agent from Jerry Zeitman. Mm-hmm. And Jerry was from William Morris. And he said, "Where you been?" I said, I just got back. I said, "Hey, how'd it go?" Like, he said, "Well, you didn't get it." I said, oh, why?" "I don't know." He said, "They went with the other guy." I said, "Well, okay." He goes, that's all right. I got something for you this afternoon. You got to do." And I said, "Hold on, Jerry." I said, I just came for this. I got to go back,
yeah,
to Canada. I got out to London, Ontario. He said, "Well," and I said, "I have a wife and a baby. I have a responsibility there." He said, "Well, you're going to have to decide about that." He said, "But they want to see you at Warner Brothers this afternoon for this Kung Fu show." And I said, "Kung Fu?" I said, "You mean like the one from the 70s? He said, "Yeah." And I said, "With who?" He said, David Carradine. I said, "Where's he been for 20 years?
Right.
Jerry said to me, "Don't worry. He doesn't drink anymore." I knew nothing about David.
Yeah.
So I went and I read for them.
Yeah.
And sure enough, they want me to screen test the next morning. And I got to sign another contract. And these contracts in my world, then, they're massive. Yeah. Like, I'm looking at, these aren't London Life numbers,
right,
at that time.
Right.
These are like hockey contracts or something. Yeah. Like, so I called Karen. I said, "Okay, I don't know how to explain it, but I didn't get the other job. But I got to do this again tomorrow. And I got to meet David Carradine. Do you remember him?" Karen's like, "Okay, well, we're fine. Just see it through, you know." Mm-hmm. So I show up at 10 o'clock in the morning, or it was a 10 a.m. screen test. I showed up around 9 because it was on the Warner Brothers lot right off Pass Avenue.
Yeah.
And we were about 9:30. I'm outside around near the office that I'm going to test in. And this guy pulls up with a driver in a convertible Cadillac. Oh, holy shit, that's David Carradine.
Yeah.
And he gets out and he lights one of his English ovals, you know, these filterless cigarettes. And I go up and "Hi, Dave, I'm Chris. I'll be reading with you." And he said, "Hey, okay, don't worry too much about it." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I thought, is that booze I smell? Oh, whatever. You know?
Yeah.
So I knew David loved horses, he and his wife. So I said, hey, look, here's the Toronto paper. And here's, I said, I had this on the plane. I said, I opened it up to Country Properties for rent. I said, look, here's a listing of horse farms and stuff for rent. I thought you might be interested if we end up shooting this in Toronto. And he kind of looked at me like, oh, I like this kid. Well, that, I don't know, that flash of idea basically came from the salesman side of me.
Yeah.
You know? I was thinking ahead. Yeah. How am I going to break the ice with David?
Right.
So then he kind of pat me on the back and he said, okay, let's go on and get this job. So we went in and I read at the time, Warner Brothers was launching a network. It was called the Primetime Entertainment Network, and it was their venture into their own, which became the WB, mm-hmm, basically. Mm-hmm. And they were going to launch three shows, Babylon 5, oh, Time Tracks, starring Dale Midkiff, and Kung Fu, The Legend Continues.
Right.
So they were making a major investment in this. And David was at one end of the room and I was at the other. And we started to read, and I realized in peripherally that no one was really watching me. They were all watching him.
Sure. Yeah.
Wondering, are we really going to invest this much money? Yeah. Is he drunk?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know if he was or he wasn't, but it was his style. He was a real enigma. So anyway, finished, and I went out and I lied down on the floor of John Levy's office, who was a legendary casting agent, really nice guy. But I was having anxiety. I just lied down on the carpeted floor. David came out of the room, and he just kicks me right in the ribs, and he says, "You got it."
Wow.
And I said, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah, they're in there talking about it. I told him you're the guy. You got it." He goes, "Do you drink?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Let's go celebrate."
Wow.
So it's about 10:30 in the morning. I thought, where are we going to celebrate? Well, he walks me across the street to El Torito, into the kitchen. Everybody knows Dave. Hello, David. Hi, David. He walks us in. We sit at the bar. They're not open yet. And orders tequila and beers and begins to tell me the story of his life.
Whoa.
And by the end of the day, I was taken out to his ranch, and that story can be read. It's been written. It was by the time I got back to my hotel at 5 o'clock, I mean, it was almost an APB had been put out for my whereabouts.
Right.
My agents were trying to find me. My wife was trying to find me. The network was trying to find me to do press. Like it was huge, mm-hmm, this thing. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really used to it. And I was half in the bag because I'd just been going one-on-one with him all day. The last thing he made me do was get on a horse bareback, and he slapped it on the ass, and it ran across this rocky field in Latuna Canyon. And I knew enough. There was no bridle, no saddle. I grabbed the mane, yeah, and I walked the horse back in. And David said, "Okay, you passed the test. I'll see you in Toronto."
Mike.
And he just disappeared into the house. Like, no formal goodbye, no hug, nothing. Just see you later.
Wow.
And I took my rental car back. So almost in an instant, this had all become very serious. And the end of this little tale is that I asked Jerry, "Who was that other guy that got the job, yeah, for Baby Talk?"
Yeah.
He said, I said, "He was a nice guy." He said, we talked before we did the thing. And he said to me, "One of us gets the job, the other guy gets his throat cut," mm-hmm, or however he put, mm-hmm, it. And I said, "But he was a really nice guy." And he said, "Yeah." He said, his name's George Clooney. He's been kicking around town. You know, he's done a bunch of pilots. He said, "Yeah, the network liked him." I said, "Oh, okay." So that was the world I was suddenly swimming in.
He did all right for himself, that Clooney kid.
Yeah, and I really admire, I'm not trying, I'm not going to draw any comparisons to he and I. It's just the one thing I could say is that I do admire is George knew what it was going to take to make it there. And, you know, he remained single. Mm-hmm. He lived in the valley. He lived in Studio City. He kept hammering away and he finally got ER. And he'll admit that was huge. That was it for him. You know, that really helped launch him into the stratospheres. But up until that point, he was like every other guy and gal, you know, competing for pilots, hoping that they'll go. Mm-hmm. Lots of failure, lots of reasons to turn and walk away. And he stuck it out. And, you know, I wasn't able to do that. I had, as they say, a family, a young family in another country. Mm-hmm. And I was not going to leave those people behind for my dream. They were my dream. And so it worked out for me. But that just started to feed the future. And television for me, we ended up having four children, and television for me was being able to be home in the morning mm-hmm. and home in the evening. Mm-hmm. And it made crystal clear sense. So when I took the Silk Stockings job, I also was offered a part in Zorro with Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones, who were unknown really at that time, at least to me. Mm-hmm. But that job came on the same day the offer came for Silk Stockings, which they were asking for a five-year commitment, but the first two seasons were guaranteed, which was unheard of.
Yeah.
They were going to do 22 shows a year for sure for 2 years, and then beyond that we'd see. Mm-hmm. Well, and we would move to San Diego. And the Zorro job was going to take me away for 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And we had these babies at mm-hmm. home, and it didn't make any sense to me. I never ever gave it any thought when it came to television or film. To me, it was just the logistics of it all, and the, because it was all opportunity. Yeah. You know, what I didn't realize was that there were people that those days that wouldn't do Silk Stockings mm-hmm. because it could, in their minds, hurt their career. And maybe it hurt mine. I don't know. But to me, it was steady work. And that's been my approach ever since. Steady work. I think I was talking with Gabe Hogan about that, and I said, you know, I've averaged 20 episodes of television for 28 years.
Yeah.
Which is about all you can possibly do in the business. So the work has always been more important, actually, than the quality, because it's all a challenge.
Right.
So I just like being in the business.
Well, you know, steady work, like you said, you can't get any more steady than 11 years at Heartland, that's for sure.
Yeah, and Heartland was another one of those decisions that in 2007, if you look back, there was a writer's strike. Mm-hmm. Scripted television was not in demand. Right. Writers and actors were panicking because reality television was taking over. Mm-hmm. And the dollar in Canada had changed, and a lot of business had dropped off. There were not a lot of opportunities. And when this offer came to get involved with Heartland, and I read the script, instantly, you know, I was a guy who had watched, with four children, I had watched everything there was to watch in the world of television that was being offered for families.
Yeah, right.
And the only thing I could watch was The Simpsons or SpongeBob and not fall asleep. Yeah. Everything else put me to sleep. And I thought, when I read the script, I thought, oh, this is exactly what's needed. This show could, this show could fly. If they get behind this, I said, I could see this thing running. And they offered me a cameo in the pilot as the father. And then as things progressed, I was advised to pass on it. And that's usually always financial. And anyway, without getting into that, I was really hoping that the deal would work and that we could come to terms and everybody be happy, because I inside I felt that this could have mm-hmm. legs. And it's turned out to have done just that. And I've really enjoyed being a part of it. And it was really nice to, at that stage, not have to carry the show with those hours.
Right.
And so I'd been through all that and all the fan stuff at a time before the internet, mm-hmm. even, before 96. And when the show started to take off and the kids, clearly were so excited about this. The kids on the show. Yeah. At the time, they were kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
Today, they're grown adults with families. But for me, it was, this is awesome. And of course, they don't want anybody's advice who's over 30. So it was sort of, whatever. Who are you? What have you done? That's always sort of how you were treated. So I thought, no problem. This is great. I'll just sit back and watch this go down. And it's been awesome. I haven't had, I don't do any social media. I don't see the point in that, but that's because of my age.
Right.
I think. I'm an actor. I'm not a product. So, I don't think I have that much to say. And if as my kids say, Dad, if you'll ruin your life if you join Twitter.
Because of all the stories you'll tell and the people that you'll out?
No, it's just, I'm opinionated, So it's best left to others. So Heartland has been a real gift, At this stage of my life, I'm very, very lucky and very fortunate. And I really like the people that I work with. The Calgary film community. Oh, boy. Coming from Ontario, when you're working in Alberta for this long, you really see how Toronto-centric this business is. To a major fault. Because you've got crews out there who are actually winning real awards, like for Revenant and for Fargo and for Hell on Wheels. And every year the press leans toward another failed show from Toronto that wins awards. It's been canceled. And as I say to Heather Conkey, don't make waves. Let's just my fishing term, it's like a big bass, just lie in the weeds. Don't raise your head and say, hey, look at us. What about us? I said, let's just keep doing this. Let other people get all the attention, because, that doesn't pay. It's best to, we've been very lucky year after year after year. So, but I've really got to endorse the film community in Alberta. And they drive to work every day, like 40 minutes, an hour. And these guys and gals all have every possible type of clothing you can have in your vehicle to prepare for the changing weather conditions. And it's really impressive. So, shooting Silk Stockings, that series, we'd film in La Jolla. We'd be on a beach. We'd be in Rancho Santa Fe. There were oranges and lemon trees around. You know, guys are in shorts and Hawaiian shirts. It was, you know, this crew does it a lot differently.
Before we get into directing, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about the character of Tim Fleming. He's very opinionated. He often stirs the pot. But it's only with a show like Heartland that's been on for 11 seasons where you get to see this character evolution, the things that he's gone through, and the man that he's really become. So can you just talk about the evolution of the character of Tim over these 11 seasons?
Well, first of all, Tim is like a compilation of three different guys I know. And so that's sort of my template. But really how it evolved, I think, was that it became clear to me in the first or second episode that it was my opinion, my feeling, that we weren't going to be able to have two alpha males on the show, in Jack and Tim. It would get tired very fast. So for Tim to play a more dramatic, a more leading man position, I thought was going to be a challenge. It could be short lived, and it might not be as entertaining. You know, for fans of the show who can recall Tim's early episodes, you know, was always a standoff,
right,
over a fence. Right. We call them fence scenes, but with Jack. So I kind of understood. I started to understand where I could find a place to perform and be effective, and that would be to play under it, under Jack, or around Jack, and be an antagonist, and yet in a more a Disney form, as opposed to the antagonist. And let's use the example of a series called Bloodline. Danny, the brother, I don't know if you're familiar with the series, is the kind of antagonist that, you know, puts you on the edge of your seat when he comes on screen. Well, Heartland's a family show. He's a Disney antagonist. He's irritating, but we're never going to make him delve into the world that, you know, he has supposedly been, you know, wallowing in for 10 years and has ruined his life and distanced him from his family and so on. So we ended up, I think Heather and the writers started to write in that direction. And I found it over the years really fun and challenging to play that antagonist. I guess Tim is a character you can love or you can hate, or you hate the fact that you love him. I think it was a symbiotic relationship between Chris Potter, the actor, and the writing team, driven by Heather, to find a place for him to fit. Each week I have to fill a different crack somewhere in the storyline. I don't know how else to. You know, we don't really ever know where Tim lives.
Right.
He's not fully fleshed out. He's got a lot of backstory, but he appears out of nowhere all the time on Heartland. So it's hard at this point to get deeper and deeper into his storyline without revealing more about his lifestyle. And that's never going to happen as far as I can see. Show's not about him. The show's about Ty and Amy. And, his role won't change. But I just hope it remains entertaining. This year, Tim goes through some big changes and some challenges. But again, it's not all about him. It's just that he's got an interesting arc. So it's been fun to play. And it all started with episode 8.
Okay.
Which I happen to have have been directing.
Excellent.
So, it was a challenge this year because I enjoy acting and directing at the same time. But in this particular case, it was a setup for Tim's story. And I was sort of responsible for laying the template in an episode, that I'm directing, but it was some heavy stuff to perform. So it was a real challenge this year. It was, real split personality happening there.
At what point in your career did you decide that you wanted to start directing? Was that kind of organic and you said, I want to stretch my wings a little bit creatively and flex some different muscles?
No. No, I think it was Stephen Cannell that came to me on the set when I was doing Silk Stockings. And he said, and he was, a voice in my world that was to be reckoned with, to listen to. And his encouragement, he had done, if you recall, he was the king of television back in those days, of Wise Guy and 21 Jump Street and On a Hat Squad, on and on. So he was the executive producer of Silk Stockings. And anyway, he occasionally performed in episodes of his shows. So he was performing a role in one of the episodes early on. And we got talking and he said, I hope you plan on directing a few of these. Mm-hmm. And that was really kind of stunned me because I wasn't used to that sort of nurturing environment. We don't do that well in Canada.
Right.
It's sort of like you either act or you direct. You can't do both.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the way it was in the US at the time. I mean, and he just flat out said that. And he said, I've been watching you. He said, I know you can do this. I can watch. I can see how you're thinking and what you understand. And I said, well, yeah, I'd love to, but he said, well, that's going to happen. And before I knew it, I was directing episodes of Silk. And it was very rudimentary because we had at that time, we had a real penny pincher of a producer who didn't like monitors on set. I mean, this sounds bizarre now, but we had very limited equipment and a tight budget, but a very efficient crew. And it forced me to stand beside the camera. It forced me to do the work and the homework in prep. And it was a great stepping stone or learning experience for me. But then there was a big gap in time where I did a couple other series, and they were done in Canada. And of course, none of that experience mattered when I got back here. And it wasn't until Heartland that Jordy and Tom from our producers said, yeah, no, we'd like to offer that to Chris and give him an opportunity. So again, it's the nurturers. You have to be a nurturer in this world. you gotta try to empower people. And I've always keep that in mind and really tried to do that myself with the young people coming along in the business that I work with on Heartland. Because it was so important to me and helpful. So Anyway, moving on. Well,
when it comes to directing, you're using are you using a different part of your brain from when you're acting? Like you're going more visual, right?
Well, the thing is, in film, you know, the camera can tell the story. You have the luxury of being, which, you know, makes for masterful filmmakers and artists. In television, it's so much about time and money, and so much about that 1 hour script, if that's what you're doing, a 1 hour show, that you can't reinvent the wheel, and you can't become indulgent in your right. vision, because it's just not going to be used. So you have to pick your moments. My analogy for directing, which I've used before, is that it's not unlike raising a large family. You're asked questions all day long, but the goal is to get everybody to bed by night. Right. But the important thing to understand is that those questions, first of all, the question usually always pertains to the person's department, you know, that's asking the question. And you've got to keep your ears open and be malleable, because sometimes some brilliant ideas come from some very creative people on a film crew. Other times, they're just questions that you just don't have time for and that don't really matter in that present moment, but you have to find a polite way of saying, you know, it's not that I don't care, it's just a decision. So it's constantly managing time and money and staying with your plan. Therefore, prep is crucial. Having a plan going in and being so well prepared that you can afford to be flexible for the unknown or the magic that might happen, or when you're dealing with children, animals, and changing weather conditions, right. you have to be very, you know, be able to dance and creative on your feet. And that's sometimes where some of the best stuff comes from. So that's very different than performing. And I guess what I find is when I'm directing, you're doing a jigsaw puzzle all day long. Okay. Your mind is constantly working, thinking ahead, leading the crew through, trying to stick to your plan and tell the story that you've prepped for the past 2 weeks, and get what you need. And therefore, you're operating at a high level of internal energy. Well, acting requires the opposite. You have to calm your mind and your body, and become relaxed internally in order to get to. So those two worlds collide when you're doing both at the same time. So the one thing that I've always tried to do is be aware of that before any scene I'm acting in, is to get my work done as a director, set up, and then take that little bit of time, you know, brief amount of time to center myself. And then, of course, when you're performing in front of a group of people who are your friends on the crew, who have seen scene after scene. They're not the most emotional group. They're not like a theater right, audience. Right. They're just, right. you know, let's get this and move on. So I usually pick a person who I know is in tune. And in the case of Heartland, it's the first ADs okay. that we have. Pierre is one of our first ADs who also directs throughout the year. And Mark Ambery, who I've worked with the past 2 years, is a super bright, hilarious guy who, you know, has seen has seen it all. He's got a ton of experience. He's a real pro. I love working with him. And I just have to look over at him and, you know, he'll give me a nod like, you got it. Because if you're acting, when you're acting, and if you're doing it correctly, you are not watching. Yeah. If you're watching yourselves, you're not doing the job. So if I'm in it and I'm getting it, I just look over and if I can feel it usually, and I'll get the nod from him. We get it. This year was challenging for that because I had some very dramatic scenes to do, and he was a huge help in terms of that, both.
Okay, so we're getting close to an hour into our chat, so I'm going to start wrapping up. And so for all the people that are tuning into Heartland this season, you've already teased that that Tim's got some dramatic stuff coming up. Overall, is there something that you can tease about season 11 for the fans? Like, just overall, we've got this new baby into the mix. Is there going to be drama surrounding the baby? What can you say about Tim and Casey's relationship? What can you tell us?
Well, you know, I have a terrible memory, actually. So, so I'm so glad you're not asking me about, you know, what's happened so far, because I just forget. I used to be terrified by those conventions way back. I'd have to do those things, and the fans would show up from all over, and they'd say, "Mr. Potter, episode 3, season 4. And I'd be like, I don't even remember the last episode we shot. What am I going to say? So listen, all I can say is that the tone of this season and the look of the season and the characters that we've introduced, I've really enjoyed. And we've brought in some really great new actors into the scenario. Going forward, we get to meet more of them, and they've really done a great job in casting some talent, super talent this year to boost, you know, and to enhance the show and keep it driving forward. As far as storylines go, the things that you, I can say that the things that you come to love in Heartland, as viewers, you're going to be satisfied, and you're going to get those things that you love. It gets difficult because we're in uncharted territory. When you get into 11 years, you know, I'm sure that there are people going, "Oh, I wish it was the way it was in year one." Well, but just like life, you know, enjoy the moment. Like, it's we've got to, families keep moving forward and marching forward into the future. People grow up and so on. Fortunately, with Heartland, you know, we haven't lost any of these favorite characters, and I think it's a real nod to the writing department, and in particular to Heather Conkey, the showrunner, who have been able to maintain the tone and adapt year after year. This show could, you know, of course I'd like to see the show run forever, but what actor wouldn't? But I think with the combination of actors and writers and producers that we have now in place, I think, you know, there's no end in sight. And there's a portion of this that we would like to bring in some new viewers and retain all of the original viewers. So I think they've done a good job in this season of catering to all of those elements and concerns. And I don't want to make a mistake right now and talk about anything coming up. other than that, I promise you'll enjoy it.
Well, thanks to Chris Potter for sitting down and talking with TVA's Greg David. Having another TVABC's podcast where Greg sits down and talks with the movers, the shakers, the people in front of the cameras, the people behind the cameras, people involved in Canadian television, TVA, the podcast. We are the television podcast which focuses on Canadian television. We are probably one of the only podcasts out there that focuses strictly on Canadian television, not just the shows, not just the people involved, but also the news behind Canadian television. You'll notice that we missed a couple episodes. Like, we've kind of fallen behind. We missed a couple of weeks. You know, it's getting into the holiday season, and there's stuff to do, and we'll get back to our regular schedule. Quick, I really promise you. Go to tv-eh.com. On a day-to-day basis, you can keep up with all the news that's happening in written form. And on a weekly basis, if you go to the podcast tab at the top, once a week, you'll generally hear us talking about the news, Greg and I. Every other week, you'll hear Greg talking to somebody who's involved in the industry. Great conversations, stuff that you need to know, people who you need to hear from. You can reach us out on Twitter at TV_EH. You can find Greg on Twitter at Greg_David and find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. Wow. There you go. More Canadian television for your ear holes. That wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.